In this episode, I'm talking to Dan Mitchell. We've written a book together, but it's really based on Dan's experiences, really since he was a child and still continuing to this day. I first met Dan when I was researching what's known as the Smiley Face Killers, so all of the unexplained disappearances and later subsequent discoveries of college-age men in rivers. So somebody had sent me a message and said, you really need to have a look at this blog. The blog was called Luminosity, and it was owned by Dan Mitchell. And I have to say that when I first started reading it, I thought that this was somebody who was maybe in their 70s or 80s, really, really intellectual, so well-educated, because his writing is absolutely sublime. It's superb writing. Well, on the actual day that I was reading the blog, I got an email from Dan. And he had been researching these cases of the drownings, or what's called the drownings, because of course a lot of them don't have any water in their lungs. But he was also looking into these cases and had been for a very long time. So ever since then, which is probably 3 or so years, I guess now, we've often been in contact, sharing ideas, sharing research, and he is a fantastic researcher. But this book, The Harlequin, is all to do with Dan's own experiences, which kind of, since they began as a child and continued until this day, have really become something that he's devoted many, many years into researching and trying to find out what it was or what it is that has really been stalking him all his life. It's a very complex tale because it's not simply an entity. As such, there's such an incredible range of really, really strange things that have happened to Dan and his family, and in fact to other people as a result. So we start off, we're actually talking about one of the recent drowning cases, and then we get into talking about just a little bit, actually, of Dan's experiences, because there is so much to it. So we cover maybe sort of the first few early childhood ones in this episode.
Because that was one that really bothered me, strictly for the fact that it was, there's no foul play involved in it. There's no hint of, you know, him really being drunk to the point where it's like, yeah, I'm going to jump over this bridge and into these frigid cold waters. It's just, he just went in. You know, he walked away from, I think it was the Bellingham Tavern, it was called. He walks away, you know, he walks, what was it, maybe a half mile, a mile down the road, and he just willingly goes in. And that is what really bothered me about that story. Because it's not like all the other smiley face drownings. This is somebody where they have video footage of him outside the tavern. They have video footage of him walking toward the river, and according to the police, they have video of him actually jumping into the water. And to me, that's just something that's just, it's hard to wrap the mind around, you know?
I know there was one case in Dead in the Water. It's kind of similar because a boy was wading into the water and two police were trying to get him to come out, and he just said to them, it's worse than I could possibly tell you, and then he drowned himself in the water in front of them. And afterwards, in the newspapers, his friends were saying that he was in a bar, he was happy, he was enjoying himself, didn't seem to have any worries, and then he went and did this.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I've spoken to a couple of detectives who were first on the scene. One was for one of the more recent Boston ones, and one was for one 2 decades ago, and both of them insisted, no, it was a suicide, but there was no obvious reason, there were no notes, there were no obvious reasons why this person would just... But they determined, but couldn't say how they determined that it was a suicide.
Yeah, and that's... Seeing that, it's very similar to Kaylin Lauder, and that was one that I covered on Luminosity as well, where you have this woman who's very professional, very much educated, And all of a sudden, there's this breakdown. And she's having this breakdown. And she's calling the police. She hears that there's... Sorry, there's like a helicopter going over my house now. It's like shaking the house. Okay. So getting back to Caitlin Lauder, you know, she's professional. She's educated. And then all of a sudden, she's having this breakdown. You know, she's calling the police, saying that she's hearing people arguing in the apartment next door. And that there may be guns involved. And the whole time, and I believe you can find these recordings on YouTube as well, her roommate is in there with her and trying to kind of console her and tell her, no, there's nothing going on. You know, you don't have to worry about it. Nobody's getting shot at. Nobody's arguing. But in her mind, all of these things are really happening. It's that aspect of a lot of these cases that bothers me, because it's like, and I wrote about this on Luminosity. It's almost as if they're getting hijacked. The mind is getting hijacked in some way, you know, and with Caitlin Lauder, what they have on a lot of the surveillance footage of hers is she's kind of acting out of sorts. She's, you know, some people say, yeah, she's out in the rain, barefoot, talking to a dog, talking to her puppy. And other people are saying, no, she's talking to herself, you know, and it's just this bizarre breakdown that kind of seems to happen abruptly. And then they're gone. You know, in the case of Zachary Marr, the details I would be most curious to hear are, what kind of things was he reading or studying or looking into, if anything, before he disappeared? Because to me, that's a big part of it. You know, I looked at Caitlin Lauder's Facebook page when she was still missing, before she was found in the river, you know, and she was big into Carl Jung and serial killers. And there were a couple other weird things I can't remember because it was a few years ago. But it's certain things like that where this phenomenon, especially with missing people, where I think that there's details that are really important to know, because those details may have some kind of bearing on the whole story of these disappearances, you know, because I really do believe, like with Zachary Marr, Caitlin Lauder, and a lot of others, that there's a very real paranormal aspect to what happens to them. You know, without a doubt, that is there. It's present. You know, so it's getting those kinds of details are very difficult unless, you know, you're close with the family. And I've never been one to contact family members of missing or people in any of these drowning cases. I just would not do it.
Particularly with the kind of things that we would ask them as well. It's not considered particularly normal, is it?
And no.
It would be very offensive to some, wouldn't it? That's the difficulty. Because I remember somebody had sent me a video that a young man had made prior to disappearing, and then his friends had left notes in the woods for him near the campus, and then he was found in the water a few days later. Well, he had actually had a slight breakdown just prior to this, and then he disappeared. But he'd made this video a few days before disappearing, and it was either just really a kind of joke between them all. So what he was saying was just a joke, and everybody understood it. But the words he was using mentioned things about if you knew the symbolism of all of this, it would be too much for you. And it was almost like he was giving some kind of veiled message that he understood what was going on, but couldn't do anything about it. You know, it was too awful.
Right. Yeah.
But then, of course, an outsider looking in and not knowing him or his friends, and coming from this angle, I could be reading way too much into it. You know, and so certainly going to his family and saying something like that is not something that do.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think even in book one, what I had mentioned is that one of the signs, that one of the things that's said really often is that this specific person was suffering from bipolar, from depression, or from some other mental issue, you know, but it doesn't say the duration of that. Have they been suffering it from those things from, you know, years previous? Is it something that came on abruptly? You know, it's things like that. And to me, it's a very clever kind of excuse. It's a way to get people to kind of forget about this strange thing. Like with Zachary Marr, that he willingly went in the water on one of the coldest days of the year. It's hard to wrap my mind around that, you know, and to really understand how someone can do that. And then to just blame it on, well, it was bipolar. Well, I mean, I know people that have bipolar and people that suffer from clinical depression. And I can tell you that, you know, these are not the kind of people that would all of a sudden have this extreme reaction abruptly. Hmm. And that's what's always kind of bothered me about these things. It seems like it's a good excuse to tell people as to why these people all of a sudden had this bizarre break with reality. Hmm. And it's very disturbing, you know, and that's why I was telling you earlier, is that the whole paranormal field, all of these different phenomena, whether it's alien abduction, ghosts, my labs, all of these things, they're all a part of this. I believe it's all a part of this meta phenomenon that is symbiotic with the mind. And when it finds good doorways in to people, it can wreak havoc on them. It can wreak havoc on their relationships with other people. It can make them do things that they normally wouldn't do. You know, it's responsible for a lot of things that the authorities and media people will call bipolar or depression. You know, there's more to this, and people are just not, I just don't think that in the times that we're living in, that people are very well versed when it comes to things like spiritual warfare and unseen things that can push people to do things they would not normally do. So, you know, this is much more than a psychological issue with these disappearances. You know, there's a lot more here. This is very deep into the unseen realm of things and intelligences that are all around us and function in nature and function in the human psyche and sort of animate things. And people can get taken over. And, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I was covering a little bit in book one and probably more so in book two.
Can we go back to 1981 and talk about how it all began for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I grew up on the south side of Milwaukee. My first real memories of anything strange are probably from 81 to 82 and the Harlequin. And I never called it that probably until 2009. But before that time, in my mind, this being was the Tooth Fairy. Okay, so this entity would kind of come into my room at night. It was very thin, very graceful in its movements, almost like an acrobat, I would say. You know, it would usually come in the middle of the night. And I remember a lot of times I was kind of sitting up and just watching it move around. And in these movements, it was communicating to me. In each movement, it would communicate. It was things that I would intuitively understand. You know, so it never spoke. It did look at me a lot, and it could communicate somewhat through its eyes as well, but it was more so in the movements. And it's really hard to explain that. And at the time, I was still really young, you know, I was 5, 6 years old. So I kind of understood it with my child's mind, what this thing was saying. You know, as far as any specific message that it gave to me, it's really not much that I can remember about it. Other than it had an appearance to it that was very reminiscent of my mother, as far as being very thin, even like the shape and kind of structure of the hands, it mimicked the way that my mom looked in a way. And, you know, looking back to that, I always thought it was somehow related to me, my familial relationship of some kind. But, you know, as I get older and I really kind of ponder these things more, it's more along the lines that this thing was perhaps trying to mimic her to make me feel better and maybe more comfortable with its presence, because it was out of the ordinary, absolutely out of the ordinary. It's just not something that people really have memories of, but for whatever reason, I retain these memories and, you know, they stuck with me. And as I got older, I kind of you know, relegated these memories to being my imagination and nothing more, you know, but they were just over the years and thinking more and more about it, it was just so obvious that these memories were very much like any other memory that I had of any event growing up. So it was not easy to just say that, yeah, these are imaginations of a 5-year-old boy. I reached a point where I could not do that anymore. It was just too obvious that there was something much more real going on here that I could not just dismiss as being, yeah, that's my imagination. So, you know, there were times where it finally got to a point as I was getting older where I'm beginning to question and I'm beginning to see these visitations as being a bit odd. You know, I would maybe say things to one of my brothers or to a parent, you know, and they would kind of look at me like I was crazy, you know, and rightly so, because here's this 5-year-old kid talking about somebody that's coming into his room at night, dancing and talking to him by the way that, you know, he or it or she is dancing. It's different. It's, you know, it's strange. It's a strange thing for a child to say to a parent. You know, it's just, it's not within the normal realm of things.
You say that you've lost memories, you've lost passages of time from your childhood, but you also then recall some memories. And at one point you say that you had a memory of your father in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Aware of it upstairs laughing.
Yeah. One of the things that he was doing is he was, and I remember this throughout my childhood, even until the time I, you know, left the house when I was 18. He was always very fond of technology early on. He was very much into it. It started out with him taking these audio recordings of kind of family life in, you know, like the late 1970s into the early 1980s. So he would have this library of these cassette tapes. And, you know, he was big on making these recordings so he could have like just a library of, you know, weird things that we said as kids and things like that. So I ended up listening to these tapes. I don't remember when it was exactly. Maybe it was like 2000. It was probably early 2000s. I've always had like snippets of this memory from this meal that we were eating in the kitchen. And listening to these tapes sort of brought that back to mind. I started thinking about it more. And, you know, that day he was we were all home and he was extremely agitated. I remember it looked like he was walking paces, you know, and just kind of pacing around the house and agitated. And I never seen him like that because he was always very strong, very laid back. Just not one to get easily agitated by anything, you know. And we sat down and we were eating this meal and we heard footsteps upstairs, you know, clearly footsteps. I mean, you just could not deny it. Our dog was downstairs with us. I mean, everybody was downstairs on the main floor. I remember he kind of stood up, and as he stood up, that we heard this laughing, and it's strange because it was almost like an electronic kind of laughing, like a robotic kind of laughing, but it had a very sinister sort of sound to it. And, you know, and this robotic voice thing pops up a lot in these experiences that I've had. But I remember when that laughter came downstairs from the upstairs and the way that it traveled, it just shook him. It terrorized him. He had this look of absolute fear on his face to the point, I mean, you couldn't heighten anybody's fear any more than that. And it was like the sound of the laughter sort of paralyzed everybody. Like you were just frozen stiff, could not move, could not do anything if you wanted to. And there was just this lingering terror that went along with it. And I remember seeing this look on his face, like it was like he just got hit with a bolt of lightning, and just this terrifying look that he had it was just outrageous, just outrageous. You know, to see that was probably more startling and more frightening to me than to hear that laugh, because deep down, I kind of knew that that laughter, what the source of it, I knew who it was coming from. You know, as far as why it happened that day, I don't know. And that memory in particular kind of abruptly ends. It just abruptly ends and everybody kind of comes to like nothing happened. You know, the conversation goes on as normal, but it was clear that there was like a very short period of time where it was, everybody was completely unconscious. So, you know, there was some kind of a discontinuity there again, where this strange event happens, there's an abrupt stop, and then it's over. Everything goes back to normal.
A bit like the scene you describe where everything turned into a big water fight in the street.
Yeah, exactly. It's very much like that. It's see, and that event came a little bit later. That was 1984, that event. And with that, I was playing and I was probably, I would have been 8 years old in 1984. I was on my front porch. It was a very sunny day, very sunny, and some kind of object went and it blocked out the sun. And it was black. It was large. I can't even describe what the shape of this thing was because it was just so, it was so large. And at this event, things get very strange because I have memories of it, of seeing parents screaming and running around the neighborhood looking for their kids. And there's sort of being just this panic, this absolute panic. And I remember being behind my house. Another memory I have is I'm sitting on the porch. Another memory I have of it, I'm sort of floating sort of above the whole neighborhood and witnessing all of this unfolding. And, you know, 10 years ago, I would have said, well, you know, this would have been kind of like this mass abduction event where all these kids in the neighborhood went missing. And, you know, I would have said that and I would have, you know, really kind of stuck to my guns on that. And I put a lot of time and I put a lot of money into researching that event in 1984 with people that I knew from back then that also remember similar events. And, you know, I pursued that. I pursued getting more information on what happened that day in 1984. You know, the strangest part, and I, again, this is another thing I wrote about years ago, was that despite all these weird memories, these disjointed memories of that day in 1984, I have this other memory that is kind of, that I guess what, you know, alien abduction people would call like a screen memory that kind of covers over everything. And that memory is of a water fight, like, people kind of running around the neighborhood, having a good time. It's a really hot summer day and there's water balloons flying and people getting sprayed with hoses and, you know, things like that. And it's a very corny, weird memory that I know never happened. It wouldn't have been possible to happen, but yet it's slipped in and it's almost like, whatever happened that day was meant to be sort of covered over, but it just didn't take. Like, these different memories are there. They have not left. And this other memory was meant to kind of cover over everything and be like, oh yeah, I remember that day. It was great. You know, the whole neighborhood came out and everybody was having a good time. It was a water fight. It was like 95 degrees that day. And that was meant to replace whatever this traumatic event was that happened in 1984. You know, and I was very serious about getting research. And even, I know I started kind of filming this little documentary I was going to do about that day with one witness in particular that I had. You know, she had very similar memories of that. She had very similar sort of disjointed and numerous memories of everything that was happening. As did one of my brothers. He also, you know, had similar disjointed screen type memories from that. And you know, it was just one of those things again where it's a normal day. The day is flowing normal. And then abruptly, something happens, something strange. And then the next thing I know, after all of this is over, I'm back where I was. Nothing has ever changed. Everything is the way it's always been. And it's things like this that I look at and I sort of realize that the truly paranormal things, the weird things, always have this quality of being disjointed. You know, it's, you know, talk to UFO abduction people. They can tell you that they have experienced these abduction events, but they can't tell you the moment that they walk through the doors of a UFO. You know, there's no continuity there. It's like I was laying in bed. All of a sudden, this light beams through my window. Next thing I know, I'm laying on a table. I'm getting this physical examination by these gray aliens. There's no continuity in the event. There just never is. So, and to me, I've always viewed that as kind of the litmus test of a genuine paranormal event and, you know, these other more outrageous events or maybe, you know, hoaxes or made up stories where people are saying, you know, they can pretty much tell you from start to finish every little minute detail, every part of it. And it's continuous for them. You know, for a lot of these hoaxes, it's always going to be a continuous story. Every little detail is there. You know, that discontinuity does not exist. So for me, that is the way to tell, you know, whether this is real or not, because there is no continuity in these things. They sort of fold over into reality and then they're just gone and everything is back to the way it used to be. It's very strange. Nearly every encounter and strange event I've been through starts this way. It's, I'm having a regular moment, a regular day, and flip the switch. Very abrupt. Something happens. And then that's the normal way that it goes. That's the normal flow of these types of events, at least in my experience of them.
The girl that had the same experience with the water fight scenario.
Yep.
She had some strange things happen, didn't she? Because she told you to stop.
She did. Get rid of everything. She wanted no part of it. I think we were a few weeks in. She wanted no part of it whatsoever after that. This was a common thing when I was writing Luminosity, where, and it wasn't with everybody. It was with, I mean, I would say it would even be the minority of the people that were reading it. But people that read Luminosity and the experiences that I had in there would often write me and tell me that they had very similar experiences. One of the most common ones was they're laying in bed at night. All of a sudden, there's there's knocking at the door or somebody ringing a doorbell frantically. They get up, nobody's there. That was a very common one. Or people had, you know, UFO sightings, things like that. But with the girl that I was working with, it was a lot worse for her. She was getting a lot of phone calls, you know, very menacing type phone calls. Notes were being left on her car, like very intimidating, kind of perverted notes were being left there. And this was a common thing. It got to the point where, and I want to say this was from the very beginning, that she believed that the source of these events was what we were working on and things that we were talking about. You know, it was just very strange. It was, to me, it was a non-issue. It was at most, it was probably going to be a tiny little documentary that I was going to put together, probably no longer than 30 minutes, 45 minutes. I mean, how many people really would have seen it? What kind of dent would it have really made? Yet, you know, here we are. There's this strange sort of intimidation going on with it. And what that was, I don't know. I just don't know why that was even an issue. but it became an issue, and it was just, you know, it was done. It was done.
So much.
Right. Right. And that sort of thing, it felt to me like it had more of a human hand involved in it. And, you know, I really don't even want to speculate on what that was or who that could have been, because it just comes off bad to make speculations on that. And I'm really not in the business of doing it, but I mean, it was kind of mixed in a way. It seemed like there was kind of a paranormal sort of aspect to a lot of that too, because it just mimicked what other readers that I had at that time were going through, you know, just with the waking up in the middle of the night, some kind of frantic event or some kind of disjointed event. It just became too much for her. And I understand. I mean, you know, she had a child she had to protect and that she was very worried about. And I understood it and I completely accepted that.
But it really astonished me when you said that people who were reading and following your blog were then having these experiences.
Yeah. And that went on pretty much the whole time I had Luminosity. It was just a very common thing. Common that I would get the emails, not that, you know, masses of people that read it were experiencing issues like that. It was just, it happened. And it got me thinking, you know, initially I kind of dismissed it. I really did. I didn't think much of it. I thought maybe these were just, you know, I don't want to say like a copycat thing or people just kind of yanking my chain on it and just like trying to tell me a story and, you know, get me to write about it. I don't know, but it reached a point where I could not deny it. And two separate people would have very similar events, you know, and it just led me to believe that I was being a spokesman for something that was sort of beyond space and time, that was able to reach out to people if it had some kind of resonating effect with them. You know, if they came there a lot and they read it and they started sort of feeling the story, that they would kind of be ripe for these things to happen. And that was really the way that it seemed to me. It only seemed like a certain kind of person would have these events happen and then kind of record them to me. You know, and I admit in the beginning, it was sort of interesting to me to see that happen and to see this weird ripple effect happen. And it was just, I was getting amazed with it. You know, over time, it was just, it didn't feel right. It felt like I was kind of being controlled to write these things and put these ideas out there. And it was just too much. I think, you know, it kind of rubbed people the wrong way. And I started seeing it myself that, you know, maybe Luminosity is some kind of antenna where when I write things, it's crawling out into the ether, so to speak, and touching these people and having an influence on them. And I mean, I really did get frantic emails from people when I wrote. Very frantic. You know, there were people that completely stopped reading, not because they were angry about anything that I had written, but because they were genuinely frightened by the phenomenon that sort of followed them when I wrote.
My God.
So it was one of those things where I just, you know, I made a note of it and I started realizing that there's more to this, that this may be a problem and this thing, whatever it is probably not having people's best interests in mind.
Yeah.
So that was, and again, that went on for several years where I would still get those emails.
And do you think that's why you took it down in the end? Took the blog down?
No, I took it down because it messed me up. It messed my mind up. It, you know, it did a lot of really negative things to me for the years that I had it. There's not a doubt in my mind anymore that there was something sort of using me as a channel to reach other people. And, you know, it's when I had that blog, when I had Luminosity, I mean, I would write articles for 3 months at a time, just get fed up with it, close it down, you know, open it back up, keep it open for 2 months, 2 weeks and close it down. I mean, it was just constant battle going on with myself on whether I should keep it up and keep doing it, you know, and it was just, and that went on and it went on and on for years. And it's funny because, you know, if you read anything, if you were to search like Dan Mitchell Luminosity or anything like that on Google, I mean, one of the things you'll find is, oh yeah, Luminosity's down again, or oh, Dan Mitchell's back. And, you know, it just goes on, and you see banning probably 2010, you know, all the way to like 2015 or 2016 when I just stopped with it altogether.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it was, it took a lot out of me to write it. It ended up in the end sort of really negatively affecting me, affecting my health, my physical health, not my mental health. I mean, I never had any issues where, you know, I had suffered from depression or bipolar or anything like that. I think more than anything, the problem I had was just confusion about what was happening, you know, because it was just so strange, you know, just related to the way people were receiving the things that I was writing, and just kind of, it was just a really rough 5 years or however long I was writing. I don't even remember really how long that was going on, but, it was difficult. So it was never really continuous for 5 years or 6 years. It was just always kind of broken down. Oh, hey, Dan Mitchell started a new blog, or, you know, hey, he's back on Luminosity. It was just always, I'm all over the place. And it was kind of an inner battle going on about whether what I was doing was right or wrong. And my whole thing as well during that time is that I was writing about things that were happening to me, but I was also exploring different ideas and strange ideas that, you know, maybe a lot of people had not heard before. But my point in doing that was that I was building up and trying to understand the structure of reality and figuring out how reality works and breaking down the weak parts of these ideas over time. So, you know, it seemed to the outside observer, it seems like, yeah, you know, Dan Mitchell's changing his story again. And, you know, he said this before, now he's saying this. And, you know, a lot of that was just sort of an inner battle going on within me, trying to figure out how things work and to better understand the phenomenon that was happening and affecting me from the time I was, you know, a little kid. So it rubbed people the wrong way, some people the wrong way, other people got it. But yeah, it was, I felt for a time, for a long time, that it was more along the lines is that I was sort of initiating people by my writing into this very weird, ambiguous phenomenon that had all sorts of different manifestations in people, whether it was like ghosts, UFOs, alien abduction events, anything along those lines. That's sort of what my writing was about. And it just had a very strange quality to it.
Can we go back to the house and the basement and the panel and the mirror and that whole setup?
Yeah. So I lived in Milwaukee, again, like I said, on the south side of Milwaukee, near this place, this Forest Hills Cemetery. It was pretty much right out my back window, kind of overlooked this cemetery. And it's an interesting place. It's a lot of Milwaukee old beer barons are buried in there. And it's just, the neighborhood is just kind of weird in general that I grew up in. The house that we lived at, and I think I want to say that we moved in 1982 or 1983 to this new house, it had a very weird sort of design to it. The basement, there was a set of stairs that went down into the basement. And at the first landing, before you got into the basement, there was a panel. And you could remove this panel, and the panel would look into the bathroom and the spare bedroom that was in the basement. And that room during the early 80s was pretty much used by my dad as his office. The mirror in the bathroom functioned as a two-way mirror, so that when the door was open in the bathroom, you could see a large chunk of the bathroom as well as part of the bedroom that was down there, or the office that my dad used. Again, nobody lived down there in the early 80s, except for a real short amount of time where an aunt and uncle lived there. The rest of the time, it was until probably the late 80s, it was just my dad's office for his work. There were times where I would go down into the basement and I would see my dad kind of crouch down with the panels removed, and he was sort of looking into that room. Why he was doing it, I don't know. I have no idea why he was. It would have been nobody living there, nobody down there. Nobody ever used the bathroom down there, because it was just, I mean, it's a basement. It's an old house. It's very cold. You know, so there was never anybody there. So it always puzzled me as to what he would be looking at or what he would be looking for. But he did this all the time.
That's so creepy to read that.
It is. And I've tried to talk to him many times about it. And it's, these conversations are cut short. There's a lot of things that he doesn't want to talk about. And I think I have a better understanding now why he doesn't want to talk about it. And that's something that's going to get covered more in book two. And I get, and it's a very intelligent reason that he doesn't speak about it. I think that he figured things out really early. He was probably about the age I am now, I think, when we were living there, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, he was about my age. He... Just to be clear, as I grew up in a Christian household, and I mean, it was very, I don't want to say it was very strict, but it was pretty strict. I mean, you know, we were raised to read the Bible, to have a really solid understanding of things theologically. That's just how it was. That's just the way we grew up. We had a small house church where a lot of people would come over for like Bible studies and things like that. So it was different. It was a different kind of a house. It wasn't, you know, a lot of my friends that I grew up with didn't grow up in the same kind of circumstances that I did. But, it was a weird house. It was a weird house. And my dad spent a lot of time down there, and, you know, and one thing that I kind of covered in the book is that he had given me a Bible some years back, and inside of that Bible, there was this typewritten note covered front and back, and it said, I forgot what it was. It was something like demon possession in the Bible, and it was every single verse in the Bible that had to do with like demonic manifestations or things like that tucked away into this Bible. Mm. And it was tucked in there with my dad's resume, which from the looks of it, if I would try to piece it together, it was probably, I mean, it could have been anywhere between maybe 1982, 1986, I would say. So, I mean, that was his typewriter. That was, you know, and I remember the kind of paper that he used. It was always this really super thin, kind of cheap paper. And it was yellowed because he used to smoke down there constantly. He was always smoking. And so I knew it was his, that he had personally typed it out, that he had taken the time to reference all of these and study all these things, you know, and he just worked down there doing that. So it feels to me in a way that he was being pursued and he was being stalked by whatever this was as well.
Yeah.
But his way of dealing with it was that he was researching it. He was looking into it. But he was also smart enough, unlike me, to kind of stop it. He didn't promote it in any way. He didn't talk about it in any way. He kept things quiet because I think that he realized early on that if you shut up about it, you don't say anything, that it sort of loses its power, it loses its influence, and it's starved out. And I think this is some weird realization he came to. And I should also say that the house that those Tooth Fairy Harlequin encounters first started in is the house that he grew up in. So he was pretty much born in that house. It was sold to him by his dad. So, I mean, this was something that he knows about that he just does not talk about, period. He just, he wants nothing to do with it, with the promotion of it, nothing.
Can you describe what he was doing with the video camera and the TV?
Yeah. Yeah. He, in that room in the basement for a time, and I don't know how long this was going on, but by the looks of the collection of VHS tapes that he had, it was going on for a considerable amount of time. What he was doing is that he had this VHS video camera, and he basically would use the camera output and he would plug it into the TV. He would point that camera at the TV screen so that you were basically, the camera was kind of recording the image that it was putting out. Okay, so it kind of worked as almost like an infinite mirror, I guess I would call it, where, you know, you would kind of, if you were to sort of face two mirrors against each other, and they would look like they would kind of go on forever, but he did this electronically. So it was strange, and I don't know where he learned about it, because I know that we saw this on a television show when I was young, but I want to say that was, and again, this is where my memory sort of betrays me, is I don't know if that was, he already knew about it and did that, or if he saw it on a show and started doing that. Yeah. It's really hard for me to remember it. But he would do this, and when you do this, you get a lot of very strange images that are recorded. I can't even explain the things that you would see with this. And I mean, you would see what looked like faces looking back at you. You would see things that look like places. Like, I mean, all sorts of things. I can't even explain. You could probably make just about anything out of it. And it's hard to say whether it's your mind trying to put form where there's just complete randomness, or if those are really structures that are somehow somewhere getting picked up and put into this electronic form and they have some kind of reality to them. So it's really difficult to say, you know, what is really going on there. But, you know, I've looked at these videos and they're strange. And I think he was doing it because he was also maybe looking for an answer on all the things that were happening, because I think that he knew what was going on in some way, but he just did not want to acknowledge it, because to acknowledge it brings it more kind of into reality. And I, you know, when I started talking about these events with my mom early on when she was still alive, you know, she told me about this recurring dream that she had about a man dressed as a woman coming to the house at night, trying to get in the house to basically slaughter everybody while they slept. And, you know, it was kind of interesting, because she had told me once that she says, you know, it always seemed like your dad was in this dream was always wanting to help this person out, but I was just supposed to, because I knew that he wanted to kill everybody in the house. And that sort of thing, he must have known about those dreams, because they were very close. There's no way that he wasn't aware of things like that, or that he wasn't aware of me telling him that, hey, I got this person that looks like mom coming into my room in the middle of the night. You know, who is this person? What is happening? So he had to have taken all of these things into account and realized them, because, you know, I have four kids of my own, and the way that my house is, you know, my kids always tell me about strange dreams that they've had. You know, same with my wife. You know, these are things that we discuss, that we talk about here. And these are things that I always want to know because I think they're important to know, especially because, you know, I do have an understanding of a lot of these things and how these things work. So it's good to know what's going on with everybody. And I think that my dad was the same way. He just was more in the background of it. He understood what was happening, but he was never one to push the issue. That's admitting to it.
Did you say that your mom used to put her ear to the carpet, thinking that she could hear intruders?
Yeah, that's when we lived in the first house that I was born in, which was a Polish flat. She used to hear people walking around downstairs in the basement, and nobody lived in that basement apartment. We pretty much used it. It was kind of like a laundry room down there, and there was a small playroom down there. And she would hear people walking around there. She would, and I remember this so well, is that she would kind of put her ear on the floor and listen, and just kind of lay there listening, like trying to make out if she could hear voices or, you know, people taking things or doing whatever down there. And it was a common thing. There was a time where it was very heightened. You know, she became very conscious of like threats to the house. And again, I was really young when this was going on, but I do have a good collection of memories from that. But it was definitely very much present. There were strange things happening. There were threats that I think she perceived. And I mean, there was a time in particular where I remember where she called my dad, and my dad worked just down the street, and he had run home and pretty much knocked that door in to get to the basement, and there was nothing down there. And I think there was a time where she may have been calling the police a lot, and they maybe thought she was out of her mind.
Yeah.
You know, that there was really no threat, that there was nothing happening, and you know, maybe she just was maybe kind of lost her mind a bit and was perceiving things that were not there, but she was very sharp. You know, and after we moved out of there were never any issues like that at all. I mean, she was never had any emotional or psychological issues and never took any medications for anything like that. I think it was just this strange period of time that exists where she was just very, had this kind of acute awareness of everything that was happening and just was kind of at her wit's end, did not know what to do.
You saw your mother in a car at some point.
Yes. Yes. And that was, again, that was back at that house, that Polish flat. Is she was in the house and my brother and I were on the porch and in the front of the house, we were just playing, and this car pulls up and she was in the passenger side of the car, and we were very puzzled. My brother and I sort of looked at each other and were very, very cautious because something just didn't feel right. She was in the passenger side of the car. It pulled up to the curb and it felt like I was being called into that vehicle. She wanted me to come to the car. But I was very, very hesitant. I remember this pungent odor, like ozone, I would call it, but much worse, much more powerful, sort of filling the air. It was very, I mean, I've never forgotten this smell. I can't really describe it as anything other than ozone or something like you would smell if an electrical component burned out. It gives off this really terrible smell. You know, she would keep saying things like, oh, I love you, I love you. But it seemed very robotic. The voice didn't quite seem right. It just didn't seem like, I just knew it was her. And it was strange because this is another part of that whole thing where it seems like the voice is robotic, where this person is a robotic clone of my mom trying to get me to come into this car. And again, I felt very threatened by it. I had just seen my mom just moments earlier. There's no way that you know, she would have been there in the house. And then I come outside and, you know, 20 seconds later, there she is in the car, pulling up, trying to get me to get in this car. And I don't know who the driver was. I didn't get a good view of the driver, but it was clearly a doppelganger of some sort.
Yeah.
And it wanted me in that car. And this to me was very real.
And you've said that you wonder about kids that are missing, and sort of have said that you felt all along that you were destined to be somebody who ended up missing.
Without a doubt. Mm. Without a doubt. And I think that began when I was probably 5-6 years old. And I would say that that's probably the first time that I felt like I was going to be taken, and that sort of set the mood for everything that would come after that.
Can you describe the strange family that there were rumors about that drove a really strange truck?
Yep. This is back in that Forest Hill neighborhood. There was talk among the kids in that neighborhood in probably mid 80s, 85, 86, about this vehicle that we would see driving around. And it was a very strange truck. And I've never really given away the details of that truck because I am curious if anybody else, you know, would ever contact me and know that truck, that particular truck and the people that were always in it. The way that it worked is, this truck would drive around and it would just seem to kind of scan the neighborhood. Like it would drive up and down certain streets, and there were a lot of one-way streets around there. And it was eerie. It was eerie because rumors started almost right away that these were, you know, a really weird family. They kidnapped kids in the neighborhood. They molested kids in the neighborhood. They killed kids in the neighborhood. And they called them the inbreeds is what they called them. And it was because they felt that some of the people that had seen them up close, that they didn't quite look right. They looked like they had some kind of physical deformities that, you know, made them, you know, they kind of gave them that title of the inbreeds, you know, and this vehicle was always around. I remember it so well. And it was just one of those things where you didn't know if the rumors were partially true. And when you're a 10-year-old kid and these things go on, it's hard kind of deciphering truth from fiction on that. The one thing that had bothered me the most about that was I used to go shopping for an elderly woman that lived across the street from us. And I would take out her trash. I would stop at the corner store and get her milk and bread and things like that. And she would usually pay me in quarters. And, you know, I did this probably once or twice a week. I would kind of run errands for her. She had told me one day that the boy next door, that he was, in so many words, that he was kind of on their list. You know, she said to watch. She mentioned the vehicle, and she says to watch out for them because she had seen them one night outside of her window, looking in the little boy's window that lived next door to her. That she felt that whoever these people were, that they were dangerous, that they were going to kidnap somebody or molest somebody. So that sort of solidified things for me because this is an elderly woman in the neighborhood that probably doesn't have a whole lot of conversation with anybody to know how these rumors are flowing. But right away she says that she gets the sense that they're perverts, that they kidnap kids or that kids should be clear of them. But how does she know this? You know, and that really bothered me because this is an adult telling me this. That she saw them, they got out of the vehicle, they were looking in windows of the house next door to hers, and, you know, it was just, it solidified it. It really bothered me. It scared me considerably. So I pretty much spread that around a little bit to other friends, you know, as time went on, and say, hey, you know, it's not just kids talking about this. This happened. They were at this kid's house looking in his windows. And, you know, again, it sort of fueled this urban legend about these people. So at any rate, one day there's this major accident on 27th Street in Milwaukee. And they end up routing traffic from 27th Street around to my street. And I'm playing in the snow, and there's these snowbanks, these really tall snowbanks along the side of the street. And it's weird because I'm kind of walking on these snowbanks, and I'm like standing over these cars that are coming down the street because it was just, we had a lot of snow that year. And in the distance, I see this truck. It's at the, you know, it's far down, you know, maybe 200-300 yards away from me, and it's making a turn. It's going to come right past me. And I remember that I wanted to go inside. I wanted to go in, and I wanted to run, but for whatever reason, I could not run. I was not going to leave or get off of that snowbank. I was waiting for this truck to cross my path. I wanted to see who was in there, what the story was. I guess I felt maybe somewhat safe because I was practically in front of my house, and that if anybody stopped, there were a lot of cars around, I could maybe make a run for it, something like that. But, you know, I don't know why I stayed. All I know is that I stayed. What ended up happening is that as this thing was approaching me, I started getting a better view of the people in the cab. They were very, how do I say it? Like they're, it was clear when they were probably 50 yards out that everybody that was in there was looking at me standing on this snowbank. Without a doubt, they were looking at me, and I could tell they were looking at me. It was like my eyes were locked on them and everybody in the car. And I just remember at that point when eye contact was made, that there was no way I could have moved. It's not that I was, you know, in a state of wonder, like, oh, wow, I really have to see these people now. It was that I was terrorized. I could not get off of that snowbank if I wanted to. Whatever eye contact was being made, whatever exchange was happening between us, they were not going to let me get off of that snowbank. And I feel even now that there was some kind of control going on there. And, you know, it was just too much. Now, as it got closer to me, I ended up getting a very good look. And to this day, I can't describe exactly what I saw. And again, this is a part of that whole discontinuity thing that I was talking about earlier. It's not a clear event anymore. It's disjointed. It's bits and pieces. Now, what I saw was what looked like they were human, but it looked like the lower jaw was missing and the eyes were just enormous. Okay, so it was a very awkward, strange appearance. It was like nothing that I've ever heard talked about before. It was almost like they just had upper teeth from the you know, upper part of the skull. But the whole lower jaw was just gone. You know, so it was, you know, really intimidating for me to see that. You know, I could not break free of that. You know, and when you see something like that, you don't even pay attention to the fact that you're staring. You're just staring, and there's, you know, you're just not really paying attention to it. And adding to the fact that I was frozen as well, I mean, there was nothing I could do. I was just staring at them. And I don't know what they were, but it, as human as I can say that they were partially, it was not human. It was not right what I saw there. It was I mean, I'm at a loss for words for it even now. It just, you know, I couldn't tell you if there were two in there or three in there or six people in that cab, but there were more. There was definitely more than I would say there was definitely more than two.
Yeah.
And it was so much happening and so much with what I was seeing that I just, you know, once it got past, it was over. I was more or less relieved and I was able to go home and, you know, that was it. And I still continued to see that. I knew a kid in the neighborhood that it was rumored and he was with the rumors as well. And you know, he had told me personally that he was taken in this van and that his parents told him not to talk about it. And, you know, that was it. So it's all these little bits and pieces of a story that add to this, I guess, you know, if you were to call it an urban legend, but I mean, I think it's much more than that. But, you know, it was strange because it was, you see this vehicle, it's associated with bad things and bad people and strange people. And, you know, it's just, there was just no other way. It was a very strange sort of part of my childhood with these people, whoever they were, whatever they were.
Yeah.
You know, and I have ideas on this and what this was, but, you know, it would take a very long time to explain it. And I really do hope to explain more of this in book two.
And Dan, the incident with the stroller is also really disturbing.
Yeah. And well, we had a cottage up north that my family owned, near Eagle River, Wisconsin. And we basically would go there. I mean, we'd go there usually once in the summer, usually late in the summer because a lot of the vacationers were gone and we could do more fishing and boating there without being disturbed or getting in people's way. We were driving on some of the dirt roads around there. And it was a very isolated cottage, extremely isolated. There were not a lot of people around. I mean, nothing was really paved. I mean, you're driving on these old country roads and in a very dense forest to get to the cottage. So we were driving, and what my dad would do a lot of the times is we would drive, and since there were no lights anywhere, no houses, and he knew those roads very well, you know, he would shut the lights off when we were driving, and it would just kind of, it was just sort of this very weird thing, and it would sort of make everybody kind of freak out in the car, you know, like, turn the lights on. And, you know, he would turn the lights on and everything's fine. But it's a really weird feeling when you're driving, you know, 30, 40 miles an hour on an old country road and you cannot see anything in front of you. Like, you can't see anything. So you're wondering if you're going to drive into a tree or whatever. I mean, he was just kind of crazy like that. At some point, somebody saw somebody up the road a ways. And it was very strange to see somebody on those roads because those roads are not paved. It's, like I said, they're pretty much gravel or dirt roads. And, you know, it's extremely isolated. So there's just not a lot of people out there. Late August, there's not going to be many people out there at all. So we slow down. Obviously, the lights are on now. And we see this person pushing a stroller. Just this guy walking down a dirt road pushing a stroller. And I remember just sort of the excitement in the van just coming to this crashing halt. And all of a sudden, this very serious tone sort of take over. And as we passed this guy, and I was sitting in the back, you know, and I didn't really want to look at him because it just, the thought of this scared me because I had been out on those roads before. And I know that if you don't have a flashlight, you cannot see anything, period. You can't see anything. It's too dark. Here we are. This guy is out there without a flashlight pushing a stroller. And the odds of that, I mean, it's just, there are no odds. It's just not going to happen. It is not going to happen. And to me, it had a very, what do they call it? Like this, the Oz effect, where all of a sudden everything gets still and quiet and you're kind of in this weird kind of state because something strange has just happened. You know, that's what it felt like. I immediately wanted to go home and go back to Milwaukee, because my concern is that if this guy's walking around with a stroller, we're going to get back to the cottage. Who's to say that he's not going to be walking around by where we are, or trying to get into where we were staying? And, you know, thoughts like that were just, I mean, that was just terrifying, absolutely terrifying. You know, so events like that were pretty common for me growing up as well. And so many times, you know, the normal atmosphere of a day or an evening would just be broken by events like this that just sort of abruptly came out of nowhere and were just over like that. And they're just so inexplicable. And I've never, you know, I've never been able to really describe these events as well as I would like to. And again, that's one of those things where there's this discontinuity, this sort of intrusion into reality of some kind of strange events, and it's abrupt. And that is how these things happen. You're not prepared for them. You don't have time to comprehend what's happening right in front of you, because it's strange and your mind just doesn't work that fast. So these kinds of events are kind of what I see is the truly paranormal, where it's inexplicable, abrupt, and strange. And over again, it happens, and it keeps happening, and it keeps happening.
You know, you wrote about the time that you'd fallen asleep listening to headphones.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, and with that, I was younger, and I was still living at home with my parents and my brothers. And this is sort of like the big intrusion when this happened. I was listening to a cassette tape, and I just sort of fell asleep with my headphones on, and my stereo was like kind of right next to my bed, and I just fell asleep. And the next thing I know, I wake up because I'm hearing like an old time radio broadcast in the headphones. And there's no way this could have happened, because you had to flip a switch to even, you know, go, you remember how old stereos are, you go off of cassette onto radio or whatever. And again, it just all of a sudden it's silent. And then I'm hearing this old time radio broadcast, and the voices that I heard were so neutral. It's, you know, the background noises, everything was very neutral. Like there was no distinct accents to anything. It was almost like if you had a cookie cutter of what a human being is, you know, absolutely middle of the road, mediocre, just a voice. This is what I heard. And it started out where they were talking about cataclysms and these terrible things happening in the world. And then this broadcaster is talking, and he says that he was trapped inside of a cave, and that he could not get out of this cave, and that, you know, he was beginning to have near-death experiences, and he was upset. And, you know, it was this sense that, you know, something tragic and terrible was happening in this broadcast, without really being completely descriptive about what that was. Now, as this is happening, there's a part of me that realizes that this is absolutely wrong. Everything that I'm hearing is wrong. This is not supposed to be happening at all. It is not normal for that to happen. It was very strange. I had this overwhelming feeling that I was losing my mind at that moment, like completely losing it. Like I felt that part of this, actually all of it, was not really coming from the radio, but was racing thoughts in my head and bad things that were going on in my mind psychologically that were leading to this. So I knew immediately that this was not some broadcast. This was something much, much worse. And I really felt as this unfolded that I was losing it more and more. And I could not keep it together. It felt like if it went on any longer, that was going to be the end of it. That was going to be the end of me, that I would not recover mentally from what was happening. And it started saying things like, we are coming through the walls. We are getting closer now. And to me, this was kind of like this phase of ingratiation where something is presenting itself in such a way to traumatize you so that it can kind of sink its claws into your life, that it can push its way in and have you and get and make you obsess over it, make you think about it constantly. And that event really kind of started a lot of things for me, because it was so real and so ominous that I could not deny that something real was happening to me, and that there was some kind of a presence that was linked to me that was really causing problems for me.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. There are more episodes like this on Patreon if you look for Steph Young Masquerade Podcast. Or I have a website, which is Steph Young Author, where you can find some of the books that some of these stories come from.